We get it all underway this afternoon by welcoming into the program our friend Colin Fleming. But first, a taste of the subject matter today from a now 50-year-old classic album from Miles Davis. Years old and every bit as revolutionary today as it was then. Colin Fleming, welcome in, sir.
Taste it, listeners.
You're not getting that on the other AM radio stations, I'll tell you that.
That's some good stuff right there. Bet you've never heard a trumpet sound quite that way before.
Not at all. And you've got a wonderful piece about Bitches Brew on the 50th anniversary in the American Interest, and really fascinating, as like everything you write, my friend, but this was great. And as somebody who played the trumpet poorly for a number of years, I have a different appreciation for it. But I love how you talked about him playing the role of musician as shapeshifter. What do you mean by that?
You know what? I put that up on my Twitter yesterday. You know what happened? I finally got a respectable number of followers. No, I'm kidding. People unfollowed me over that.
Really?
Come on. It's a great piece of Miles Davis and a great venue. I don't get humanity sometimes, Kimball. But
nobody does.
What you have, yeah. Grim, man. What you have here is Miles Davis, who was, we've talked about John Lennon on this program before. Miles Davis was, if anything, he was a worse human being. But he had a questing spirit, and he really followed this directive of making it new. He was either involved in or directly or kind of on the peripheries of a lot of seismic shifts in the history of not just jazz, but popular music, because he is there at the birth of bebop with Charlie Parker, because they were buddies. Now, the problem was Miles Davis couldn't play nearly well enough at the time, or really any time, at that kind of speed that Parker required to contribute to those sessions. But he was right there at bebop in 1945, and now here we are in 1970 with Bitches Brew, which took a direction that no jazz album ever had. And what Davis was doing, as you mentioned, is he was playing, and he was central definitely to the sound, but he was this orchestrator. He was the architect of the sound, even as it was being recorded. So what he's doing, he said afterwards, he wished there was video of the session. Mm. He's running around the rehearsal space, the recording studio, and he's pointing at people. You do this. You do that. He's giving all these commands, like you're a silent film director, like you're F.W. Murnau in the 1920s. And a lot of this was assembled after the fact, post-production. But there are really two sides to Bitches Brew, what was recorded and then what came out.
You also talk, Colin, about the direction, the suggestion, I guess maybe the challenge that Miles Davis was given by Clive Davis.
Right. Clive Davis said, look, dude, this stuff isn't selling. What Miles Davis was doing, because he was a greedy MF-er, was borrowing against his royalties. And he was living this life. He had like Ferraris, and he just was living it up. Great life. And horrible to women, but great life for his own leisure, sensual pleasures, comfort, all of that. And Clive Davis said that you need to, we don't just want to keep handing you this money. You need to start playing rock venues. Go out, and Davis heard this as open up, which is what it really was, for people like the Grateful Dead or the Byrds, whoever was playing these psychedelic ballrooms at the time. Fillmore East, Fillmore West. And Davis, you could say hello to Davis in a way he deemed the incorrect way, and he'd want to stab you in the throat. So, which I respect. I'm a little like that myself, so I get it. But Davis wanted no part of this. He storms out, and he didn't want to. He didn't respect usually white people, but also rock and roll musicians, rock musicians at this point. He thought they... Correctly. I mean, they couldn't read music. They were completely different sorts of musicians than a guy like this was. This was someone who could write down music, who understood music conceptually. Not that his music was better, but he understood it in technical terms that people, you could be Hendrix. Hendrix didn't understand it in the same technical terms that Miles Davis would. So he finally relents because he doesn't have much of a choice and he wants to keep the money coming in. But he was just really horrible to white musicians. Like, for instance, Steve Miller Band. Now, I think Steve Miller pretty bad at music, but Miles Davis thought he was at least as bad as I do. And he would show up late when he was supposed to open for Steve Miller. This is right around the time Bitches Brew is coming out. So Steve Miller has to go on first. Davis rolls in with his band and just destroys everything that, like, you could have wanted to achieve if you were Steve Miller. And Steve Miller's like, this sucks. I don't want to do this. And Miles Davis is like, yeah, taste that. So there you go.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. And also when it came to the making of Bitches Brew, he basically told the producer, don't worry, I got this, get out of the way.
He did. Now, Teo Macero was integral to Miles Davis's sound over the years. And they worked on a lot of things together. You have to realize that Davis was chameleonic. He would change what he was doing. This is the same person, this molten fusion rock jazz hybrid that we hear in Bitches Brew. It was not that long ago in some ways that he was recording cool jazz, which is the antithesis of this sort of music. And Macero was invaluable to him in direction and getting all of the players in the same sort of corner to sally forth and do what the band wanted to do as a whole, following Miles Davis' guidance. But this time, Davis said to Macero, he said, look, brother, just get out of the way and record everything. Everything. I don't want you to fiddle with it, anything like that. If there's some stray note, that might be an essential stray note. Don't shut anything off. And what I wanted to do, too, is I wanted to write a separate piece, and I wasn't able to, ran out of time, didn't have the venue, where I wanted to do something called Raw Brew, which was to look at that original session, those session tapes. It's almost like you have this jungle. It's a really impressive jungle. And it's just, there goes a python and there's a wild boar and what the hell kind of bird is making that sound? And then that's the raw tapes. And then you have the album. And the album is like this citadel that has been carved into the jungle. They still have a few wild boars and the pythons and the birds making strange sounds and all that. But it's a bit more kempt, if you will. It's like not quite hair down to your ass, but to the middle of your back, sort of thing.
You would describe it. Go ahead, Colin.
And then after that, so then they get in the studio, and here's where things get really interesting to me. Because you think of jazz as just this kind of live, record it, get it down on tape type of deal. You don't think of it as this Sergeant Pepper, we'll do a little plug, Harry Houdini-like, right? Magic in the studio type of deal. But that's what they're doing. They're adding blips. They're adding delayed effect. They're phasing things. They're automatic double tracking things. Davis is playing with the Harmon mute, which makes it have this kind of bitter tone to the trumpet. And they're putting this weird fuzz box on that. And it's coming out not like it actually sounds. Some of it does. And the session tapes. So it became this real after-the-fact post-production. Think of like Orson Welles with his movie Ola, right? And he has all of that raw footage. He's in the hotel room in like Naples or wherever, and he's staying up all throughout the night to get this edit that he wants. And that's what Davis was doing. And then Mastera was having a big hand in that too.
An incredible group of musicians that he gathered together as well. And basically everything was okay as long as whatever they did was built from the root notes of the chords.
Yes. And what's interesting about that is it sounds completely different, but his command as such wasn't that different from what he said with the kind of blues session, which we've talked about on here, where he has John Coltrane. He has completely different, Coltrane's dead by this point, but he has a completely different group of players. He has Bill Evans, has all of those, Jimmy Cobb, those sorts of guys. It's at the end of the 1950s, and that was based off of scale. And it all comes back to this simple premise of, like, look, you can take the root of the chord, and you can do anything you want with it, but it has to come from this root of this chord. And I'll give you, like, different chords that we're going to use after that, And you know what? He hated Ornette Coleman. Like, he really thought he was an imbecile. Miles Davis thought Ornette Coleman was an imbecile. And he thought he was a complete fraud. But what Ornette Coleman was doing, too, when he arrived in New York City in, like, 1960, and the whole birth of the new and free jazz was going to come out of and all that, he was doing something similar. It sounds more atonal than what Davis was doing. But it's not that completely, it's not really this sidebar type of thing. There's quite a bit of overlap. So the difference here is the volume, the electricity, and then there are so many keyboards on this music. That really is the, it has this wave-like texture to it. This, but not just waves. We think of waves like aquamarine seas and everything. These are waves at night. These are big, black, right, frothy, foamy, fumy waves coming in upon Pangaea. And that's the sound that the keyboards, the electric keyboards, really give this double set record.
And you described it in your piece on the American Interest as a new kind of wall of sound.
Right. So people who are rock and roll fans will be familiar with Phil Spector and the Ronettes and Be My Baby. And it's like you're standing there when you listen to it. It's one of the reasons that kind of music is so pleasurable. You're standing there and there's this big towering billow above you, right? And it's like, oh, wow, it's going to wash over me. But it's going to feel good. It's like Splash Mountain. And you like it. Here, it's not so much pleasurable as it is immersive. It's almost like an undertow. But you're not going to drown. You'll eventually be able to get out and be like, oh, wow, Riptides, that sucks. But here I am, this beach. I'm so grateful to be back. But that, I think, is really what the best art does. It's going to immerse you. It's going to clutch you. And it's going to, there's something violent about great art, even when it's beautiful. It takes possession of who you are. It does what it wants to who you are without your consent, really. Your consent is simply being there. Using your eyeballs to read, your ears to listen, whatever it might be. And it gives you back yourself to yourself more like who you are, really, than when you came into the room in the first place. So there's this weird paradox, sort of metaphysical conceit, big idea going on, and this is a good example of what that can sound like.
The other thing great art does, and you and I have talked about it a number of times before, is it takes risks. Miles Davis was never seemingly afraid of that, but boy, a whole lot of other people in the world today are, because we just don't see a lot of risk-taking these days. Why is that?
Because, well, for instance, in something like publishing, there is absolutely no risk-taking. There's me. And when we say risk-taking, that doesn't mean like Russian roulette, like this might work out or I might blow my brains against the wall. That's not what we mean by this. What we mean by risk-taking is doing something that is not the same old hackneyed, boring BS that offers nothing to anyone, even in theory, which no one can get anything from, which is simply a copycat of stuff no one else wanted in the first place. It's the art version of the prevent defense. It is the human version of playing not to lose. And when you play not to lose, you lose. And one thing that might very well happen, and it's opening up some things for me, frankly, with this COVID-19 deal, is that something like publishing is maybe not going to be around when it's over, at least as it has been. I see the pack ice starting to break up, because the reality is no one wants your pastiche of a pastiche of a pastiche. It doesn't work. People want Snow White. They want Star Wars. They want Sgt. Pepper. They want Bitches Brew. They want people singing at the end of the symphony if you're Beethoven. They want something new. And what happens is there's this trickle-down effect. It's not just that it's not put out. You have all of these places, record company executives, people at film studios, people in publishing. They're looking for, I call it the barbed wire sock, where it's not like they see the sock that's so well-designed. It'll keep you warm. And you can walk through water. Nothing will happen. It's great, comfortable. Always smells fresh. They get this idea, these hallmarks they're looking for. It's like, oh, that's a ripped apart, dirty ass sock with some barbed wire threaded through it. Yeah, that's what we've been putting out. Let's get us some more of that. And what happens is people out there, the people who make the stocks, start putting barbed wire stocks, start threading them with the barbed wire. And then that becomes the skill set. That's what's taught in schools, film programs, music conservatories, MFA programs. And then that is all anyone can do. And the people who had talent, it becomes buried like it's under a rock. And then it goes away if you're not always trying to develop your talent. So then there's no one really, hello, I can, but who can overturn this? And it just becomes this mounting and mounting problem. So, like, that's why people aren't reading. That's why people aren't as into music. It's really that two-way street where nothing good is coming out. And they also don't want to put anything fresh and innovative coming out. Miles Davis was someone who said, no, I'm going, of course, by this point, he was still well-established. He had that going for him. But he said, no, I'm not going to follow in this pointless line. I'm going to do something innovative. And it worked.
How do you get the average person, if there is such a thing, to acquire a taste for that, though, if they've been raised on pablum, if they only want what they expect and what comforts them? How do you get them to take a risk as consumers of art?
You don't have to. You've read enough of my work. You think if we get 100 people in a room, how many of them are you think are not going to like City? All of them are going to like City. All of them are going to like Dark March. All of them are going to like Buried on the Beaches. That's not the problem. You sit people down when Star Wars came out. All the people liked it. There wasn't something like it before. People respond to good things. Look, this isn't Finnegan's Wake, okay, the type of thing I'm talking about. This isn't The Bell Jar or some Gertrude Stein novel, like some code-cracking sort of reading or listening. This isn't Free Jazz, even by Ornette Coleman, or some minimalist blast music, anything like that. People like good things. If you play them, The Searchers, A Rear Window, or what was the story we were talking about the other? It feels like forever ago, 6 feet away,
yeah.
Right? And you said, I wish everyone in the world could see this. The New Yorker published that story, right? What do you think would happen? A lot would happen. People would love it. They'd write into the New Yorker and say, I can't believe you. Where did this come from? How did you get this so fast? This is better than anything. I'm renewing my subscription. I was going to cancel. People will respond to it. People respond to even radio like this, people who listen to a lot of radio. This segment itself right now, it sounds different than most radio you're going to hear. But you're not thinking, oh, man, I don't know. I can't come out. No, you like it. It's good. It's funny. There's edge. It's intelligent. Two people who like each other. There's rapport. It's good radio. It turns you on to some interesting music and some ideas that you can take out into your life and reshape and reformulate and share with other people. It's different, but it doesn't mean that it's not accessible. There's a big difference between that which is not being put out and backed and that which we cannot grasp. I've given you the example of the Beatles before, and the Beatles are, their records come out at the end of 1963 in the United States, early 1964. This is before Ed Sullivan. I wanted to hold your hand. No one's interested in it. They're hearing it on the radio. It's when they get this big marketing push behind them. The exact same music. Now, people weren't lying that they loved it, but they were ready to embrace that right away, and nothing, my goodness, sounded like She Loves You. Still nothing sounds like, yeah, She Loves You. That's why it's beloved.
Colin Fleming, always making us think. We appreciate that, my friend. Thank you for being with us today. Let's do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, buddy.